KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Spokane area airfields as details emerge about a plane crash in Kyrgyzstan on Friday. Three Fairchild Air Force Base crew members died, including a mother, a father, and a plane enthusiast. Paige Browning reports.
People remember Captain Victoria Pinckney as a mother and college rugby player. Technical Sergeant Herman Mackey III was a humorous father of a young girl. 27-year-old Captain Mark Tyler Voss was building an RV-8 plane. Vice President Larry Tobin of Spokane's Experimental Aviation Association says Voss was a new member there.
So this is very popular for pilots to build and fly their own airplanes. And that's what Captain Voss was doing. Him and his buddies were working on this. They rented space here to complete this airplane and didn't quite get it ready to run before he went on the latest deployment.
Tobin leads a four-ship formation team that will kick off Spokane's Armed Forces Torchlight Parade this month with a tribute to the three airmen who died. Fairchild is planning a public memorial service for the crew. In Spokane, I'm Paige Browning.
And I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
It's 54 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to get up to 74 this afternoon. These morning clouds are going to go away and it's going to be sunny again. Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com.
From KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. You've heard of doubting Thomas, but the question is if you can be doubtful and faithful at the same time. The three interfaith amigos are going to take that up later this hour, and our regular Tuesday gardening panel will be in as well. But first, Microsoft is in the process of overhauling Windows 8. You can get ready for Windows Blue if you're a Microsoft user. Nick Wingfield covers technology for the New York Times, and he joins us now with more on this. Thanks for being with us, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
So we've all heard that Windows 8 has been less than the spectacular success that Microsoft had hoped.
That's right. I mean, the sales of Windows 8, or rather the sales in the PC market, are really pretty disappointing. We're seeing declines in the market, and now Microsoft is trying to respond to some of the concerns that their customers have had about it.
What has been, I guess, the biggest issue with the Windows 8 system?
Well, if you've seen it, it's pretty evident that it's probably the boldest new design for Windows that we've seen in decades. It has a tile interface that looks very different from the Windows desktop that most of us are used to in our workplaces or our homes. And they did this new interface partly because of the explosion of these touch-based devices, tablets, but also other devices that have touch screens. And that's really what this software was designed to take advantage of. The problem is a lot of their customers aren't buying those devices. They're buying traditional computers with keyboards and mice, or keyboards and trackpads on laptops. And in that case, it doesn't look like the software is nearly as easy to use as it is on these touch-based devices.
Is that partly because there's a sort of an operator ramp-up system that it's hard to learn, or is it because it actually doesn't work well?
Well, I think it's more the former. They say that there's a real learning curve. If you've been used to the way Windows looks, has looked for the past two decades, and you see this new thing, then it's very challenging. I do think it is easier for people who have tablets to learn how to use it. In fact, what Microsoft is saying is their data show that customer satisfaction is pretty high when people have touch-based devices with Windows 8 on it. But when you're talking about somebody with a computer, a traditional computer, that it's harder for them to learn. And so with Windows Blue, the next version, they're calling it an update to Windows 8, they're trying to respond to some of those concerns to make it easier to use. And it's not 100% clear how they're going to do it, but there's certainly been a lot of speculation that they will bring back the ability for people with traditional computers to simply boot up their systems and be in an old, familiar-looking Windows desktop.
So essentially, I've got Windows 7 on my computer in my office just down the hall. If I put the new Windows Blue on it, it would sort of look the same as what I'm used to seeing?
Well, that's the idea. That's certainly what the speculation is. Microsoft's not confirming that yet. That old familiar desktop has actually been there in Windows 8, but Microsoft has treated it more like an application within Windows 8. The problem is that there are a lot of people who just want what you have, Windows 7. They want a computer that just looks like their computer has always looked, and it sounds like Microsoft may be getting ready to give it to them.
There's also a change, or at least a concession on the part of Microsoft towards tablet makers, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, they had to do this this redesign partly because the iPad was starting to chew into computer sales. There are a lot of things that you can do on your computer, not all of them, but there are a lot of things that you can do on your iPad that are really substitutes for what we've used computers for in the past. So they needed to do something. There is really also an issue that they've been having in terms of Windows 8 sales. They haven't had enough of these touch-based systems out there. Microsoft's vision is that touch will be a part of all computers. A traditional clamshell laptop will have a touch screen, and you see very few of those on the market today, but they're hopeful that by the holidays or the back-to-school season that you'll be able to walk into a Best Buy or any other store, and you know it'll be hard to find computers that don't have touch screens on them. So that could make Windows 8 a lot easier to use.
How are these changes going to affect the Windows Phone?
Well, for now, they're two separate things. Microsoft has a different operating system for its phone, and I guess the theory here is that if Windows 8 is a big success over time, and people get used to this new kind of tile-based interface, and developers, you know, the people who create programs for the system, get used to it, then that could somehow carry over into Windows Phone, because really, the interface is fairly similar. The guts underneath are not identical, but the interface on top has a lot of similarities. And I think somebody who starts getting into the Windows Phone really likes the interface, and then also, you know, they may also start to really enjoy the interface on their Windows 8 machine as well.
One of the things I wonder when we consider the health of Microsoft, I know the last earnings report, despite the disappointing sales in the Windows Phone and Windows 8, they hadn't taken a huge hit. But I wonder how important is it for Microsoft to be keeping pace, I guess, when we talk about hardware and devices as opposed to developing usable and cutting-edge software?
Well, I think it's critical. They are now in the business of making effectively computers with their Surface tablets. And the intention of that was to really show the way to the rest of their hardware partners out there in the world, most of whom are not known for the kind of cutting-edge innovations that we've seen from Microsoft, or rather from Apple, and even some other companies in the industry. So it's important, but it's still a very small portion of Microsoft sales, Surface, that is. Of course, they're in other parts of the hardware business with Xbox and so on. It is important, I think, for them to be there, because we're in an industry where increasingly consumers want total experiences and not a kind of disconnected experience where it looks like the software and the hardware weren't kind of thought of as a coherent whole. Whether or not it ends up being the bulk of their business, I think it's still important for them to be in there to effectively have a beacon for their hardware partners.
Well, it's interesting, Nick Wingfield, in your post on the New York Times Bit blog, Microsoft spokesperson that you quoted obviously it's a public pronouncement, but didn't seem panicked, seemed sort of as if she wanted to reassure people that we kind of expected slow, and these changes that we're making to the Windows 8, the new Windows Blue, you know, it's a smallish thing. Is it really so small to them?
Well, look, they're still they're still, you know, they said they sold 100 million licenses for Windows. That includes both, you know, sales to the PC companies that installed it on their systems, as well as upgrade disks to people out there, just you know, regular people. And that's on par with the sales of their previous version of Windows, Windows 7, in the same time frame. Now, there, it's when you dive into those numbers, it's not entirely clear. You know, there is a bit of a disconnect between that and the numbers that we're seeing from the rest of the PC industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that the company is very good at making money and of finding new ways to make money. And they are selling a lot of copies of Windows 8. So I don't think it's panic time necessarily, but they do need to figure out how to make users more comfortable with this system if the direction that they're going in is going to be the right one over the long term.
Nick, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
You bet.
Nick Wingfield covers technology for the New York Times, and he has a post about Microsoft's reimagination of Windows 8 in the Bits blog in today's New York Times. This is Weekday.
Some thoughts on the role of doubt in faith in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, Botanicare, Fox Farm, and more. Baker Creek Seeds, now available, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
A sunny day is on the way. There are some clouds this morning, but those are going to go away. Forecast says it's going to get up to 74 this afternoon, currently 54 degrees. Whether you're growing flowers or veggies or you want to focus specifically on native plants, our gardening panel has answers to your questions in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Doubt is often a part of religion. What is the role of doubt when it comes to faith? The Interfaith Amigos are here to share their thoughts and the personal doubts that they've experienced. They are Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph, meditative synagogue in Seattle. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Pastor Don McKenzie, a former minister and head of staff at the University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Good to see you.
Thank you, Katie.
So let's start with the big, big question. Was there ever a time when you had doubts serious enough to think that perhaps you were going to set down religion entirely?
Yes.
You guys
didn't ever do this? Yeah, I did. I was on a sabbatical doing research for a paper I was writing, and the stuff I was looking at brought up the question, what if religion and even spirituality is just something we all made up? I'd been a minister for 18 years at that point, so I'd been in the business and so forth, but it was a real knife through the heart because I think anybody who has the experience of wondering whether that whatever gives life purpose and meaning is false or even worse, destructive, there's nothing underneath you when that happens. And so there were a couple days when I was alone. I was in a place by myself, and so I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. But I emerged from that maybe 3 or 4 days later, remembering that Paul Tillich, one of the great Reformed theologians in the Christian Protestant tradition, had said that doubt is an essential part of faith. And I think that looking back, I would say absolutely. I mean, that was a moment of growth, but it was painful, important, because I think I moved from one sort of way of understanding spirituality and religion to a new, more important one.
Was that not a question that you'd ever considered in your...
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think that, you know, for example, those late night discussions in college, and they're all about politics and religion. You know, it's about, in other words, it's what gives your life purpose and meaning. And I think underneath that, there's always an undercurrent of questioning whatever it was that we had understood to be true as children and maybe adolescents, and taking that as an important opportunity to say, what is it that I really think is true, and so forth. And those were important times.
How about you, Jamal?
You know, of course, I have always been told that doubt is an essential part of faith. And I love that sentence which says that to really have a true understanding of faith, one has to move from what is called borrowed certainty to inner certainty. It's a process. It's a journey of awakening. As for the question, did I experience doubt? Absolutely. And, you know, I continue. It becomes less and less. A specific example I particularly recall is when I used to visit Children's Hospital for a variety of reasons. And when I used to visit some parents who had children there, and I did it over a number of days and weeks and months, I began to realize or began to have that feeling, why, what have these children done? It's not that I doubted, but it makes you think. It makes you really want to figure out the puzzle. What is the purpose of all of this? And I think for me, the satisfactory answer came in my heart when I met these parents whose children died in Children's Hospital, and they were so angry at God, so furious, so filled with rage. And they would come to, you know, for counseling, and we would talk. It took some time. And when these same people became the most passionate, the most ardent devotees of whatever you might call that, God, Jesus, Allah, then I began to realize the mystery of it. And I love stories. I love this particular story, which I've always remembered since childhood, where a Bedouin was asked, an Arab Bedouin, do you have faith in God? And then he answered, you mean that God who has sent me afflictions, poverty, illnesses, made me go from country to country to country? But as he spoke, he entered into a state of ecstasy. And that to me is the great mystery. The mystery that if you have lost faith in God, but you do the healing work, then somehow your faith in God, through that process of doubt, of the journey of moving from knowledge of tongue to knowledge of heart, makes your faith in God so strongly anchored. That to me is the greater mystery.
Hmm. Ted, any great doubts for you along the way?
It's interesting. As I listen to my colleagues, I'm trying to find how that relates in my experience. I'm a child of the Holocaust, which means that I'm in a generation that was confronted with the question, you know, if there's a God who has control and God allowed that to happen, I'm not particularly interested in such a God. Like, I wouldn't want to be friends with that God. Or God really can't do stuff like that. You know, really human beings have the power and the authority to wreak havoc or to wreak love and compassion on the planet and on each other. So one of the things in my tradition that kind of supports doubt is that there's no particular theological orientation that is demanded of a Jew. I suppose the limit would be we can't have any more than one God. We could believe there is no God, or we could believe that God is not a personal, like a big guy or a big woman somewhere in the sky watching and making all these decisions and pulling strings. So I very early on rejected any notion of God as puppeteer. It just didn't make any sense to me. It was something I couldn't abide. So that kind of doubt didn't shake my participation in Jewish practice or in the Jewish community, except where I was in settings where people had beliefs that I couldn't tolerate. The time when I almost left Judaism, I was already a rabbi. I had discovered, or I was in the process of discovering, the importance of meditation. and I was discovering more inclusive states of consciousness than I ever knew existed. And I got to a place where that was so important and so crucial that I literally decided that if Judaism did not have spiritual practices, by which I meant meditation, ways of accessing those more expanded states of awareness and states of consciousness, that I couldn't stay a Jew and I couldn't stay in the profession of being a rabbi. Interestingly enough, I guess that opened me to either the discovery or the recovery of deep meditative traditions within Judaism, which were not part of my rabbinic education, which were not part of what was available for somebody studying Judaism at the time. This was in the late 70s, early 70s. And then I discovered right out front that even the basic watchword, what was called the watchword of our faith, the Shema, which is the statement in the verse 4 of the 6th chapter of Deuteronomy, was a focus of meditation. And the whole thing changed for me. You know, so to that extent, I moved through that kind of doubt of the whole Jewish tradition to discover a richness that was almost an embarrassment of riches.
I'm speaking with the Interfaith Amigos. That was Rabbi Ted Falcon. We're also here with Pastor Don McKenzie and Imam Jamal Rahman. And we're talking about the role of doubt in faith, which we've kind of scratched at with all of your personal stories. But if you had to put a place of doubt for doubt in the picture of being a person of faith, what is doubt's role?
That's a great question.
Yeah. I think it really forces a person, as I was saying earlier, to really move from a knowledge of the tongue, just parroting, roboting, you know, in a robotic way, to a knowledge of the heart, to make it experiential, to really have a taste of it. That's why I like what the Quran says. Quran says, you know, just to say I believe in God, that's just based on hearsay. That's not faith. That's called ilmul yaqeen. You have to move to a deeper state. And then the next stage, says the Quran, is aynul yaqeen. You have to self-witness it. You have to be there, observe, be mindful, be aware, awaken. And the last stage is haqal yaqeen. You have a taste of it. It really bubbles up from within you. And that is faith. So during all this time, there is that doubt. It plays a role of really allowing you to just not talk about it, not just parrot it, but to have an experience. That's why I love this saying by Rumi, who says, all the theologies of the world are as nothing compared to one whisper of the beloved. That process, that journey, it requires doubt.
Don, after you went through your experience of doubt, after so many years of being a pastor, do you think that you were a different kind of teacher after that experience?
Yes, I think so. I think it helped me to connect to some of those earlier questions I had been asking in college, and it felt good. I mean, I think doubt is an invitation for us to grow. I think it says we're thinking and not just parroting, as Imam Jamal just said. And so it's a great blessing, but it can be excruciatingly painful because as each of us has said, you know, if whatever is sort of underneath and giving us purpose and meaning, if we suspect it might not be there, then we're nowhere, at least for that moment. And that's an existential drama, to say the least. Yeah,
is that there seems to be so many people that thinks that you can't have any doubt when it comes to your spirituality or religion, that you're supposed to just believe, otherwise, you know, you need to walk away. Is that why, or why do you think people feel that way, Ted?
I think that helps us deal with the basic insecurity of being a fragile, separate self wandering around in a sometimes inhospitable planet. I don't think it does so productively. Frankly, I think that kind of belief, It was once explained to me when I was talking to a Catholic priest, and I had been having trouble. I was teaching incoming Hebrew students at the rabbinical school. And with one priest that we were doing fine, and there was another priest who found some of my attitudes difficult. And the one whom I consulted, you know, like what was I doing that was upsetting this other guy, said, look, there are two kinds of theologies. One is a lobster theology and one is a backbone theology. And the lobster is very hard on the outside but mushy on the inside. And they have to maintain their strictness because they is just a hard shell. But the backbone, you have all kinds of possibilities of movement and greater resilience, so it's possible to have discussions and have doubts and have difficulties and have challenges and share them and work through them and grow and evolve. And I think that's still true. I think those people who take the kind of faith that can't be, really it can't be discussed. It's either this is it and everybody else is wrong. If you agree with me, you're okay. If you don't agree with me, you're not okay. That's not a stance of inclusivity. That's not what I would call a spiritual stance. It's a kind of stance which is trying to maintain some kind of order and some kind of security in an extremely insecure world.
Did you have something you wanted to add, Jamal?
I was just smiling because I was thinking of the Islamic sages, you know, who say that when it comes to God, it's based on doubt and actually bewilderment. Prophet Muhammad, before he died, he exclaimed, "Oh God, we have not known you as we should have." And Rumi, who I adore very much, he said, you know, the lover visible, the beloved invisible, whose crazy idea was this? That's why I love that sentence, as we have said many times, settle your cleverness and buy bewilderment. Ultimately, faith rests on bewilderment, I think.
And with bewilderment comes doubt?
Yeah.
More doubt, and again, more amazement and wonder.
Don, did you want to ask?
Well, I was just thinking of that Rumi quote, that bewilderment suggests a condition of being where doubt can be accommodated and seen as an invitation to growth and so forth that we need. I mean, I think all our traditions invite us to grow. And if we get into a situation where growth is suppressed or rejected, that's a clue, I think, for us that there's something wrong.
Pastor Don McKenzie is former minister and head of staff at the University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. And Rabbi Ted Falcon, a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He is also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle.
And we have no doubt about those things.
those
are written down on paper, credentials in hand. Together, they're the Interfaith Amigos. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
The Interfaith Amigos talked with KUOW's Katie Sewell about the role of faith in religion. Hear more discussions with the Interfaith Amigos at KUOW.org. Now, what about the role of doubt in gardening? Our panel of expert organic gardeners is here to help you regain your faith in your green thumb in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Avalon Northwest Landscape, offering custom landscape design and construction to expand a home's living space into the outdoors. Committed to quality, client satisfaction, and environmental stewardship on every project. Portfolio online at avalonnw.com.
Cloudy this morning, but it's going to be sunny this afternoon, they say. We're going to move from our current 55 degrees all the way up to 74 later. Then it's a clear sky overnight with a low of 53. And tomorrow, Wednesday, a lot like today, clouds in the morning, sun in the afternoon, and a high of 75.
KUOW and Seattle Center present Festal, a year-long series of events highlighting the distinct cultures and common threads of ethnic communities in the Pacific Northwest. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
10:34. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Three Cleveland women who were missing for years have turned up alive. Three men have been arrested in the case. An update in 25 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. It's Tuesday. It's May. The world seems like it's gone crazy into bloom, so that makes it a perfect time to sit down and talk about gardening with our panel of experts. And they are here. It's great to have you all here. I'm going to do this alphabetical. Laura Matter, who's a practicing horticulturist and has been for the last 30 years. She's the Garden Hotline Program Coordinator at Seattle Tilt. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Greg Rayburn is Vashon Basin Steward. He works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands. And he's also the co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And you're looking very sun-kissed today. Got you been outside,
yes,
have you?
Yes, I definitely have.
And certainly not least but last, Marty Wingate, who writes about gardens and travel at her website, martywingate.com. And her most recent book, I believe, is Landscaping for Privacy.
Yes.
It's nice to have you here, and hopefully your microphone will turn on as well.
Oh.
There's a weird fan sound. Our phone number, 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or email us at weekday@kuow.org. Warm, not quite as warm today, but it's going to be, I think, up into the mid-70s, which means that everything has gone nuts. But I guess I'm going to throw this to you, Laura. I'm a vegetable gardener in containers. I have lettuce, I've got kale, but like, what about all those warm weather things? Do I need to wait, or is this it? It's here.
Well, it's a great question. it's nice weather. It's good at the moment for things, but I would be cautionary about what the weather does in the next week or so. So if you get things out now, they'll be okay for a few days, provided you've already hardened them off. So hardening off is a matter of getting them used to all colder temperatures as well as the sun. So a lot of people don't think about that heat issue. So that 87 degrees we had is really hard on a plant when you just throw it out there right in the middle of it. But yeah, a little protection down the road might be a good idea to consider and keep in mind.
What about things that I would direct seed, like beans?
Bush beans.
Bush
beans.
If your containers already had soil in them, the soil's nice and warm. I say plant.
Yeah, I think we're there for beans. Beans are one of those kind of middle-of-the-road things. Like it a little bit warmer, but not as much as a tomato or pepper.
Okay, well, thank you. You've answered my particular question. If you are listening with a gardening question, you know, you might be sort of still sunstruck from the last 4 days of whatever this weather has been. But our phone number, 206-543-KUOW. And Judy in Issaquah, you were a quick dialer, so you're on the air first. Hi.
I have you on speed dial, that's why.
Okay, well, welcome.
Is there any value to pre-soaking vegetables to put out at this stage of the game, or just get them in the ground?
You mean the seeds?
Yeah.
Depends on what they are. Peas, you know, we're getting a little past pea season, but peas are good. Some people do that with beans. I don't do it a lot. I just directly plant, or I plant into pots to plant out later, and I have pretty good luck with that. I wouldn't worry about that with smaller seeds like carrots and those things, and beets certainly not. Those things will just germinate pretty easily.
Okay.
Well, have fun out there.
Thank you so much.
We're expecting no real measurable rain until perhaps the weekend. So there you go. Sandra wrote in earlier today, we have three lovely Washington hawthorn trees, which were planted in our parking strip as part of Retree Seattle. They're 10 years old, well-established, and they were thriving. However, the hailstorm, remember the hailstorm a few weeks ago? It hit just as the new leaves were emerging. Huge numbers of the tiny green leaves were knocked off our trees. The next day, when the hail melted, there was a bright green carpet on the sidewalks beneath our trees. Now the remaining leaves have matured. We see the canopy's taken a beating as well and will be significantly less dense than usual. We plan to give extra water through the summer. Should we fertilize? If so, with what? And what else can we do to help these trees?
Oh, I think if the trees are well established, they don't need any fertilizer. And you may see some fresh new leaf growth as the spring progresses. Yeah, they could. It does use up a lot of energy for the tree, but I would say don't do anything.
Nothing?
They're tough trees.
They are. They're lovely, and they have great fall color.
But you can see that she's feeling sad for her tree. She wants.
So
the best help you can do, since they're 10, is
do
that
nothing.
They're just love them.
Yes.
Hug them. We're talking gardening, as we do every Tuesday in this segment of the program. And Amanda says, I just redid a flower bed, and I had to transplant some tulips and daffodils. They'd stopped blooming, but the foliage was still green. Do I need to do anything to make sure they bloom next year? Don't you normally have to wait till all the green stuff dies?
You should wait about 6 weeks after a bulb blooms because the leaves are photosynthesizing and sending food down to the bulbs to store. If you have dug the bulbs up, you can, I have done this, just take them off, leaves still attached, put them in the corner of the garden, you know, in a pot lying there, let them just die back, the leaves die back. You don't even have to plant them again right now if you don't want to. But protect them from any excessive rain that we might be getting. Plant them again in the fall.
Are we getting excessive rain anytime soon?
No. Well,
I hope not.
In between now and September, let me say
that. Oh, okay.
How's that?
All right. Well, you know, you never know. We could have excessive rain next week.
Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, of course.
That's always when the excessive rain comes in. You make it a busy signal, but if you want to call, 206-543-KUOW is our number. Hi, Amanda in Tacoma. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling looking for something to plant that's easy to take care of that can't be killed.
Are you looking for a ornamental plant or a vegetable, something to eat, or tree, shrub?
Anything. Shrub would probably be good because it would take up more space.
What are you trying to do with this plant? I mean, are you trying to block a neighbor?
No, just trying to make a yard look not awful.
And is it in the sun? Is your whole yard in the sun?
Yes.
Well, there's you probably want something that's evergreen. You know, that's a good thing to start with, something that's there all year long. And there's a wonderful shrub called the Mexican orange. Choisia is the botanical name. And if you go to the nursery and say, I would like a Mexican orange, Choisia, they'll point you in the direction. They're blooming right now. They have white flowers that have a lovely light fragrance. They're not heavily perfumed, but I can smell ours from 2 or 3 feet away. Really pretty, glossy leaves that last all year long. And you can get you often get more flowers in the fall from them, too. So that's a nice shrub to start with.
And do they need to be trimmed a lot?
No. Oh, no. I like to get shrubs that suit their situation so I don't have to mess with them. Now, you need to give it room. Mexican orange may get to 5 feet high if you leave it alone, and it could be 5 feet wide. So if you have a nice corner or space along the fence, possibly, or near the front porch that's that big, you won't have to do anything to it.
A couple of really tough native ground covers that you might want to throw in there, too, are kinnikinick and beech strawberry. Now, beech strawberry will spread very readily, so there may be a little maintenance eventually if it grows someplace where you don't want it, but they are successful. Although with any new planting, especially if you're planting in dry, sunny areas, and if you're planting this time of year, you'll still need to water it in and watch the water, you know, keep them, provide supplemental watering all through this summer. And then and maybe next summer, too, to make sure they get good established roots. Then you're home free.
Good luck.
All right. That sounds great.
Thanks, Amanda, for your call. We're talking gardening with our guests. That was Greg Rayburn and Marty Wingett. Laura Matter from the Garden Hotline at Seattle Tilth is here as well. Barb has a question, I think, that goes to you, Greg. I was involved in a plant rescue 3 or 4 years ago on a property that was to be developed. The plants returned. The pots were only supposed to be held in my yard for that year, but here we are years later. The sword ferns are doing great. The snowberries are doing way too well. They're taking over the place I'm holding them. Can I just cut them down low? They are healthy, 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 and they may actually go into the soil this fall. I just need taming advice.
Oh, a person after my own heart. My pot collection has several of those rescued plants that just haven't been put in the ground yet. Yeah, you're dealing with a couple of very tough plants. The snowberry, in fact, if you are cutting it back, you can even propagate it readily from cuttings, which is really nice. So you don't have to.
Maybe that's why hers is so healthy.
Exactly. You can cut it back and start new ones if you'd like. But it sounds like your plan is great. Just hold them over until
you're ready to go.
I have a question about snowberry. Is it that it suckers ever so slightly, or does it root when the branches touch the ground, or both?
It roots, the branches will re-root when they do touch the ground, but it also spreads from the base, too. So it's a very successful plant.
So she's going to have a nice garden. You can tell that it's May because our email and our phone lines are jammed. So I'm trying to get as many of you in as possible. Nina is on a 27th floor in Belltown?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, 27th floor in Belltown, a very, very windy balcony and very exposed to the sun. And I haven't had much luck with herbs, potted tomatoes, most flowers, except petunias do okay. I have a large bamboo, which is okay, and a smaller Nandina, which is not dead. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions about herbs and vegetables and flowers.
Okay.
Gosh. Windy conditions are tough on things. Any kind of shelter you can provide, if you can use that bamboo as a screen for some of the wind, provided you have enough sun, you should be able to help yourself there. I'm surprised that the herbs haven't been doing well because they are typically, a lot of the herbs we use are Mediterranean, grow on really windy slopes in their native environments. And I would think that things like thyme, oregano, lavender, and rosemary should do okay there. The rosemary might be a little iffy during the winter winds, a little bit cold for it. But what have you been trying?
Rosemary's done okay.
Yeah.
It's more the, more the tender herbs that are.
Yeah. You know, well, things like basil are tender, period, no matter where you put them. So those just need a little protection. If you can put them down low, that might help. Ground covers, like Greg was mentioning, the beach strawberry, but even just a regular strawberry would probably do pretty well there. They're used to being, there are a lot of seaside or lakeshore plants, and they're in windy areas.
Any kind of tomato that would do well in a pot that you would think?
Yeah, you're going to look for a determinate tomato, one that grows as a bush rather than as a vine.
Okay.
So when you look for a tomato, look for that. And look for some that stay shorter rather than taller, and they'll be bushier and more sturdy for you.
Great.
And you might be able to position some kind of glass panel or plexiglass panel that'll let the light through but also provide protection from the wind.
Well, that's a good idea. Good luck with that garden, Nina. It's nice to know. I always like when I look up at an apartment and I see growing things.
Yes, you can see trees.
Trees.
All sorts of things.
It's true. Katie says, I've recently moved to Spokane from Seattle. In Seattle, I had Lithodora, Ceanothus, and Clematis. Will these plants thrive in Spokane, or do I need different plants in my yard?
The California Ceanothus will not thrive in Spokane. I can tell you that right off the bat. What was the first one?
Lithodora.
Lithodora, I don't know. It's kind of tough.
They're saying six of one, half dozen of the other.
Yeah. You
Laura,
know,
we can't see her. We need a cam.
When you move to a new climate, the best thing to do is to go visit local public gardens, and you can go to Manitou Park. Manitou Park has the most fabulous perennial garden, one of the best I've ever seen, including gardens in England. And they have a wonderful rose garden, and they have a fabulous Japanese garden. And also visit your local nurseries, because they'll you can see what grows, and they'll tell you.
But it's also, I mean, we don't get many hard freezes, and I'm assuming, I haven't been to Spokane in a while, it's cold there in the winter, right?
Yeah.
It snows. And
yeah, that's why I'm a little leery of the Lithodora. It sometimes is a little frost tender, but, you know, also, I echo what Marty said, but take a walk around neighborhoods and look at what's actually thriving in people's yards.
There are native Ceanothus that will do well in Spokane.
Okay, so she just needs to find out where to get them and not dig up someplace without adding them first, right?
I
know you, Greg. That's you.
There's some good native plant nurseries in.
So. Okay. Scott's in Olympia. Hi, thanks for joining us, Scott.
Hi. I have a, I'm calling about a problem area along the west side of my house. It's obviously in the shade all morning, and then it gets slammed by the sun. And when things I planted in the past, they kind of like want to lean out and tip over. And I was wondering what would do well in that situation.
What have you tried before that hasn't worked out well?
Well, some flowering plants like lilies, Asiatic lilies. I was wondering if there's anything that would do well, in the food variety. But it gets extra heat there because it's along the wall.
How many hours of sun does that get?
Oh, I'd say 6+.
Oh, wow. You could try lots of things. I'm a little leery about if you're talking about lilies are leaning, that other things that like the sun are might do the same thing. So
anything low growing may be better.
Well, I'll tell you, bearded iris on the west side of our house do really, really well. And it's the same situation. They're in shade half the day, and then they get blazing sun up against the house. And you just can't stop them. Yeah. They're great.
Greg, there's some natives that would probably do well there.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Yes.
Oh, did you, there's... The reflective heat can often cause a problem for drying out things. That might and is it actually under the eaves as well?
Well, I just redid it. I did a kind of a raised bed, and I moved it out from the eaves, so I actually have a pathway along the under the eave.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to be the first time I'm going to try this with rich soil, and I don't have anything planted in there yet.
Yeah, well, a nice shrub that would handle the sun and the conditions that you have is red flowering currant, which would be a real beautiful one that attracts a beautiful shrub that it also attracts hummingbirds.
Oh, okay, well, that's good. Food crops would probably be out.
I'd give it a try since the first time you've built the bed.
Yep, and keep it watered.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Good luck with that garden, Scott. Another vegetable-y food option question. Jim's in Bellevue. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning. My wife planted a raised bed garden for the first time in our backyard. Basically a full sun situation, except for the early morning. We planted a variety of vegetables and herbs, of course, but any tips about the lettuce? I've heard lettuce is not easy to grow, and I've already noticed after 2 weeks that it's starting to look a little bit sad.
We're going to actually fade you down, Jim, because it's almost incomprehensible from your phone line. Lettuce is looking sad in this raised bed.
Lettuce actually should be fairly simple to grow. Needs a fair amount of water. As long as it's dry, you want to make sure you're watering it. How often have you been watering that?
Twice a day.
Oh, well, that might be too much water, too. So there is such a thing as overwatering things. Root systems, if they're too saturated, you can kill the roots. So check the soil before you water. Dig down about an inch or two and make sure that it's dry down there before you add water to it again.
Okay, one quick question.
Okay.
I took the copper banding with the adhesive backing, and I basically wrapped the top of the raised bed boards in it against slugs and snails. Is this an effective deterrent?
It could be, provided there's no slugs and snails already in the soil.
That's right. You're keeping them in as well as keeping them out.
So do keep an eye out still. Slug traps work really well. You could put like a little cottage cheese container sunk into the ground with some beer in it and see if you're trapping anybody.
Or it could be like my lettuce where they climb up the side of a big beer barrel and in and eat the lettuce plants.
Of course.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Good luck. Our phone number 543-KUOW. Nebras says, I have full-grown eggplant, which gave me fruit last year. And before the cold spell, I brought it in and kept it alive all winter. It has beautiful flowers now, but they're not turning into eggplants. And after some time, they just brown and fall. Any suggestion how I can make it so fruit comes along? The plant is still inside by a large window.
Are you hand pollinating?
Well, this is an email.
That would be a question.
It's an email,
so,
yeah. They're picky eggplant here, aren't
they? They are, but you know, if you have it indoors and it's not getting access to pollinators, you're going to need to do that for yourself. So take a little Q-tip and, you know, pollinate those flowers. Go from flower to flower.
And don't they need a certain set of of heat requirements
well,
and things
like that?
Well,
it sounds like the plant is thriving and blooming where it is, so I wouldn't be worried about that.
I have had horrible luck with eggplants. I'm just saying, and mine were outside. And
I go to the farmer's market
and buy
my eggplants.
Yeah, me too. Diane says, I bought a perennial vine last year, and unfortunately, I didn't keep the name of it. I know it's not a clematis. She has climates. I'm thinking clematis or a wisteria. And I remember it has white blooms, which were out last summer. It went dormant over the winter, but now it's not doing anything. No buds. Should I cut it back completely or just wait and see if something happens?
Well, what a good question that is that we don't know the answer to because we don't know what the plant is. Yeah, wait and see is always the easiest thing to do.
Okay, wait and see. Matt says we have a lot of grass coming up through our garden. We pull it out. It keeps coming back.
Grass is evil. I hate grass.
It is the worst weed. That's Japanese dog.
All right, so what do you think that Matt should do?
Oh, well, it depends on what type of grass it is, too, partially. If it's a grass like quack grass, you might need to dig the whole area back up again.
Mm-hmm. Darn white stolons running all over the place underground.
Or you can always also, if it's a flush with the ground, you can build a raised bed over the top and put down cardboard or newspaper and just kind of sheet mulch the grass out and build a new bed on top of
Although that won't keep quack grass out. I've experimented with that.
Through cardboard?
No.
It is vicious. It is a hardy thing.
Yeah, it is.
So essentially, you have to keep at it. Is your advice to Matt? Keep at it, Matt. Randy in Redmond has a tulip emergency.
I really do. It's awful. So a year and a half ago, I planted about 100 bulbs east facing in front of my house, and they came up last year just beautifully. They were gorgeous and gigantic, like bowls. And this year, they're half the size, maybe a quarter of them actually tried to bloom, and they seemed to die just as they were blooming. It looks like I stood over them and just poured water on them until they rotted. I have no idea what's going on.
Everybody's nodding here,
yeah,
so they do.
So the thing about those gorgeous, big, showy tulips is that they don't come back well, as you can tell. So the best thing to do with tulips like that is to plant them in containers. And then you can treat them as annuals and toss them on the compost pile, which is what I do. I have a couple of tulips. I have just been noticing this from years and years ago when I put them in the ground. I have one tulip coming up in one bed and one tulip. This is from a big clump and one in another bed. And they have puny flowers on them every year. And I keep thinking, why can't I just find them underground and get rid of them? So there are tulips that do well in the ground. There are species tulips and Greggii tulips.
But they're not going to be big and showy.
They're not the big showy tulips, no. The big showy tulips put in containers.
Okay. So unfortunately, Randy, this is what you can expect from a nice hybrid.
Dwindling. Next year will be even worse.
Sorry about that, and good luck. We'll try to squeeze this last little question. What's the best way, Sally wants to know, to determine and demonstrate the health of 100-year-old spruce trees to allay my neighbor's fears that these towering trees will fall on them in the night? You have a quick answer?
Well, you can always offer if they want to have an arborist come and inspect them and provide professional reassurance.
There are consulting arborists. Yeah.
It sounds like a neighbor might want her to take her trees down.
Mm. Plant Amnesty has great referral service.
Okay, so go to Plant.
An arborist that won't necessarily recommend removing your tree just for work.
Okay, so an arborist who's going to certify the health of your tree is the best way to do it. Yeah. And sorry, all the rest of you, but you can tune in next week because we've run out of time.
Or come to the Master Gardener Bellevue Demonstration Garden on Saturday. I'll be talking there. It's free, 10:30.
Oh, she's so
or
good at that.
You can call the garden office.
And the garden hotline.
And lots of plant sales this weekend. Go to the Facebook page.
Laura Matter's been practicing horticulturist for the past 30 years. She's the garden hotline program coordinator for Seattle Tilth. Marty Wingett's work is at martywingett.com. Her latest book, Landscaping for Privacy. Greg Rayburn, you can see on King County TV's Yard Talk. And he's wandering around Vashon and Maury Islands, making them beautiful and safe for habitat, natural habitat. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellet is the man at the helm. I am Marcy Silman. Join me again tomorrow at 9 o'clock for Weekday.
10:59. Seattle school kids are being asked to start conversations about gun violence, and they'll be using bricks formed from melted guns as the catalyst for those conversations. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has more in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW and Ben Arroyo Hall present National Geographic Live's In Search of the Ancient Maya, featuring speaker William Saturno, May 19th through the 21st at Ben Arroyo Hall. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Okay, here's a question for you. How do you want to die? And how do you want people to grieve you? Is that something you've thought about? We're going to talk about it today during the noon hour. Help us prepare for that discussion by telling us how you want to die and how you want to be mourned by calling right now, 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Contemplating death today at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from Verity Credit Union, a nonprofit financial institution serving the personal and business needs of Seattle area.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.